Now in 1 Timothy chapter 3, as we are going through this book of Timothy, which is Paul's letter to a young pastor at Ephesus. Very interesting chapter, not quite as controversial as the last few chapters we've been going through, but it's controversial still in different places and stuff. It's dealing with the officers of the church and the characteristics that they should have if they seek that office, as well as some of the duties and things like that. And there's all kinds of things that we can extrapolate from the chapter. A lot of insight about what church looked like then, and I would suggest also should look like now. And there are some subtle differences, and there's some major differences as well. I've had the, I don't know if you'd say benefit or handicap, one, to not really have known a great deal about the way modern churches work as far as their leadership and government and things like that. I don't really know much about how the dynamics of associate pastors and elders and deacons and the things like that, or what they're even called nowadays. Honestly, I mean, even when I have gone to churches frequently, I really haven't had much interaction with that, the actual government of the system. And I think in a way, well, I just realized today, actually, that as I was going through the this chapter, chapter 3, and it's been, I've been going over it, you know, off and on for the whole week, and also the previous weeks with the other chapters, but it just kind of hit me that I am starting to develop a picture of what was meant here and what the churches really looked like, and I have just struck with the idea that I think that this system, if applied, would really prevent a lot of Satan's wiles. A lot of the ways that he takes down churches today would be impossible if this system was in place and could be kept in place. And that would be the hardest thing too, because but I don't think it would be impossible by any means. I think this is how the church started there, and as long as people are following these guidelines, like a playbook of how it should go, I think that you would definitely prevent a lot of Satan's usual tactics. And one of his most primary targets is the churches, and specifically the people that are running the church. And mostly what men build is a pyramid type system, and if you put one person at the top of that system, it's very vulnerable to Satan's attack, because, well, you just made it easy for him. All you got to do is attack one guy, and you've attacked the entire church, essentially. But thankfully, the Holy Spirit, through Paul here, has given us a lot of tips and tricks in order to build a solid foundation with our churches in order to not only prevent Satan's attacks, but to be able to bear a great deal of fruit and to do so in a way that Jesus would continue to be the absolute authority of every church. And anyway, so let's jump right in. In verse 1 it says, "This is a true saying, if a man desire the office of bishop, he desireth a good work." Well, Paul says it's a lot, true saying or trustworthy statement, and it basically is just him putting emphasis on what he's about to say. And what he says is, if a man desire the office of bishop, he desireth a good work. The office of bishop, this word bishop is episkopos, for which we get the term episcopal or episcopalian, and it means just overseer or superintendent, and it seems to be used in most Scholars and commentators are agreeing here that this word episkopos seems to be used synonymously with the word presbyteros in other places in the Bible, which means elder or old man, is what it literally means. And it also is used synonymously with pastor, which is shepherd and minister. All these seem to be the same thing, kind of just the overseers or the elders of a church. And they have certain qualities that are expected of these. And then there are a separate category in this chapter for deacons. And that's the other thing that seemed to be dealt with. There seems to be two main separations of officers in the church. That is what he calls here bishops and deacons. So let's look at a few of these things. Today we have a lot of different names for officers in the church, like bishops and ministers, pastors, elders, things like that. One thing that's really, really funny here is that the word reverend is not used at all in the Bible, and it means terrible. And it's a name that's only applies to God in the Bible. Paul, in the next few verses here, goes through the different qualities that he expects out of the officers in the church. And I think that it's really interesting that it seems like he is fishing for particular qualities. A lot of things we look for in our churches today are very practical and things like that, stuff like administrative skills and intelligence and personality, things like that. But these qualifications here in 1 Timothy seem to be fishing for integrity in different types of ways. I don't think there's anything wrong with running a church in the different forms, like a business or anything else, as long as those appointed to run it like a business, the elders in the churches, and to decide the direction of that church would be subject to these qualifications here in the pastoral epistles. As long as they are doing that, it doesn't matter if it ends up running like a business or not, or what the form it takes as far as a lot of those things, as far as how actually it all works. You know, the nuts and bolts types thing. But in the New Testament, it is interesting how it all came to be. And the first appearance of deacons is in the book of Acts, chapter 6, verse 4. And I think this really helps explain the role of what we're talking about. The bishops and elders are explained by the appearance of the deacons. I hope I'm not losing you here, but the apostles in the book of Acts were the first elders. They were the first elders in the church of Jerusalem. And there arose a problem in Acts 6, and they urged the church to appoint 7 men to distribute food for the widows. It was a food distribution program. So they appointed 7 people to oversee this food distribution program. And that's what most people agree is the first appointment of deacons. And we have a lot of deacons in our church nowadays. You know, they are the people doing the books and those kinds of things. I mean, the deacons are pretty much everybody that's doing any other job except for elders and pastors and things like that. So anybody else doing work for the church essentially would be a deacon under these definitions. So, but what's interesting about this is not so much that, but why the apostles said they were appointing them, which was that they were going to give themselves over continually to prayer and to the ministry of the word. Their job, as they saw it, was to discover the mind of Jesus, who was the head of the church. And so that's apparently one of the reasons they appointed deacons, because they, as elders, were busy studying and praying to discover the mind of the Lord. But if we are to give more than lip service to the idea that Jesus Christ is the head of each individual church, I think having a corporate group of people that are dedicated to discovering the mind of Jesus for the will of the church is absolutely crucial, and not kind of the situation where people are like, well, yeah, we all agree to that, but, you know, in the meantime, let's just make a decision and appoint somebody to make that decision so we can just, you know, that's not necessarily, I think, you know, I could be wrong there, but I think that part of having this idea of a corporate eldership is important because it really it makes sure that there is no top tier there. And that's a completely foreign concept in the New Testament, this idea of a boss or, you know, a head of final decision maker or something like that. I'll quote a little bit here from Ray Stedman. The elders are the human instruments for the divine direction of the church. They are the means, they are the channels through which these innovative, surprising approaches to life, which the Lord and His church knows about, are carried out and brought into being through the body of Christians who meet together. Elders are to be watching for this. This is what the word for elder episkopos means, looking over. Elders are to be looking to see what the Lord is doing with His people and utilizing the opportunities that arise in every hand. Elders are individuals, have no special authority. No elder can be a boss in a church. Churches that allow pastors to become tyrants and dictators fail to fulfill the New Testament pattern. No pastor or elder is to be alone individually, given any kind of authority. Elders are ordinary Christians, just like everyone else. They are brothers, they are not in command, but they are corporately, as a body of elders, are to meet together to seek the mind of the Lord. All right, moving on to verse 2. It says, a bishop must be blameless, the husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, of good behavior, given to hospitality, and apt to teach. That last one, apt to teach, is something that we don't find later on in the deacon's requirements, so this seems to be something that's kind of a deal-breaker, that you have to be able to teach in order to be a bishop or an elder here. But the first thing he says is a bishop must be blameless, and that sounds like none of us would really qualify for being a bishop under these rules. But thankfully, in the Greek, that word doesn't mean as we think of it now. It has this connotation of that to be above reproach, to when you are charged with something, to be not guilty of it. J. Vernon McGee puts it like this: when he has been a pastor for all these years, he found out very quickly that he would be blamed for quite a lot, and he found it very troublesome because he wasn't able to answer a lot of the charges and things like that. But he found the best thing was to live your life above reproach, to not be guilty of the things that you are charged with. And I think that has in it the connotation of just that one thing, to be blameless, and that connotation really describes the type of person that you would have to be in order to be a blameless person. It encompasses quite a lot, really. The husband of one wife. Now, this is taken a lot of different ways, and I think it's okay to take it two ways. It may even be the reason that it was said in such a way. Literally, this means to be a one-woman man. And obviously, or not, I guess not quite that obvious, but at Ephesus at the time, there was a lot of polygamy, by bigamy, of course, but certainly even polygamy, and it was very common. Sometimes we forget about those kinds of things, but I think that even the early church might have even gone to some kind of heresy about, oh, you can have two, three wives, you know, if you want to. I mean, I want to carry this practice over to my Christian life, you know, a former pagan or whatever. I think this kind of nipped that in the bud pretty quickly. But also, it does seem to possibly have the connotation of that you must be married in order to be an elder. And I think that there's good reason and grounds for that, too. But people would say, well, Paul wasn't married. That's true. Paul didn't really refer to himself as a bishop, though, but it doesn't really matter. I see your point there. And Paul, you can make a case that it's better not to be married in a lot of cases. Paul, you can make a case out of some of the things that Paul has said. But at the same time, there's a lot of people that say Paul at one time was married because, even though he probably wasn't there, that maybe he was a widower. They say that because at the time if you were going to be a Pharisee or a Sanhedrin, I don't remember which one it was that he was supposedly one of. And it's not, even that's not explicitly stated. And some people argue and wonder about that, if he actually was one or just the son of one. But if he was one, he would have had to have been married. And Chuck Missler, I think, points out that he wouldn't have had a lot of time for a wife after that because he was very type A personality, and he was always in the can. He was always doing time in the local penitentiary, so he wouldn't have been a very, very good husband. But anyway, so primarily it probably means not to have two wives, but I do think it very well could mean to be married too, because I could see a benefit in that, especially in just a lot of the things that you would be, like we were talking about earlier, there's a lot of arrows that Satan can put into to try to tempt people and things like that. And often he does this even when they are married. It gets them to, you know, commit adultery and things like that, because that can break up a church and cause a great deal of harm and stuff like that. So, but I think it's possibly more easy to tempt a single person than it is a married one. I am sure of it, actually. But either way, I'm not too sold on which one it is, and as I said before, I think it could be both. Okay, the next thing he says is vigilant, which here, it says sober in other points in this chapter, but here vigilant actually translates to sober, and it does have the connotation of not drinking a lot of wine or anything, but it also has the connotation of temperate, to keep your cool, somebody that is pretty level-headed, as does the next one, which is translated here in the King James as sober, which means serious, means business, knowing the real value. I find myself to be a serious kind of person, but that doesn't mean I don't think that I am without a sense of humor. I don't think that's what this is saying at all. But a serious person does tend to want to concentrate on some of the more important things, you know, and want to keep bringing it back to relevant and things like that. Kind of a serious about the job kind of guy. Sound mind, sane is the actual definition. Good behavior. Here, this word is cosmios, which is translated in different places as modest when it was speaking about apparel in the last chapter. We get a lot of words from this word cosmios, including cosmology and cosmetics and things like that, which basically means order out of chaos. But here, orderly is a good possibility, or good behavior as it's translated here. But basically, it has the connotation of modesty, which again, these qualities are, as I said before, they're fishing for integrity, I think. So you can't really just be a modest person and somebody could say he's a modest person and not really be modest. You know, it's something that speaks of a different inner peace, and I think a lot of these things do. The next one is similar. It's hospitality. You must be given to hospitality, giving to the poor and things like that, which is a very crucial part. You find that Cornelius in the New Testament, when Peter was told to go to Cornelius, and who was a Gentile, and the first Gentile that Peter ever converted and gave the mystery of the gospel that Gentiles and Jews were to be of the same tree. He used Cornelius, who it mentions Cornelius in the sense that one of his greatest things that he did was he was very hospitable. He gave to the poor and things like that. And it seems like God really is paying attention to those kinds of things. Apt to teach is the last thing in this verse. And this one does, as I mentioned before, is a distinction that these elders or bishops must have that's different from the deacons. So this is something obviously that you should be able to do if you're going to seek the office of an elder or a bishop or whatever you want to call it. An elder must teach. This is from Ray Stedman. He must be able to expound the scriptures, to correct those that are misusing them, to recognize error when it happens, to confute those that are antagonists, as Paul wrote to Titus in Titus 1:9, and it's not just that we should teach, it's that we should be continual students in the Word, too, as the apostles mentioned there. And we all should do that. I mean, we are all, in that sense, ministers. And ministers is something that is used of just about everybody. Ministers is just kind of a term for worker. So we are all part of that, and we all are in the full-time ministry in that regard. And it's helpful to really understand that churches and being in church and learning the Word is like going to, the way we apply it today is like going to a gas station and then just parking at the gas station, just staying there for until, you know, you're idling your car, runs out of gas, and then you just fill it up again. Churches and things like that should be a place where we fill up and then go out into the world and shine the light. And I think that if again, these qualifications are adhered to and the people are doing all their jobs and everything, the things that you're going to be learning in the church are going to be make you want to go out and teach people and tell people about it and things like that. But also to do the things like the apostles, the reason they appointed the deacons was their food distribution program. A good part of the church's job is to do good things, to do those kinds of things, to have the community be impressed, and even if you never sought anything for it, but it's like, hey, these Christians are good to have around. These Christians are helping us out and things like that. So, I don't know. And that can be taken too far, too. I think some of the recent churches, that's all that they do. I mean, that's all that church is to them, is just helping the poor and things like that, and that's all they focus on. And, you know, just about anything can be taken too far or focused only or solely on that, but well, that's another story. Verse 3, not given to wine, no striker, no greedy of filthy lucre, but patient, not a brawler, not covetous. Not given to wine, this is very interesting to me, because here it says not given to wine, and later on when referring to deacons, it says not given to much wine. So it seems to be suggesting here that there is no wine to be drank for somebody that is wanting to be an elder or a bishop. But you can drink some wine if you are going to be a deacon. Having said that, and I think that there's a reason why this is said here, why they have no wine, not given to wine here for the elders, and then for the deacons, not given to much wine, so it's allowing certain kinds of wine here. I think there may be a reason for it, like John the Baptist was told not to drink any wine. He was completely abstinent for wine for some reason. I think that God probably has a reason here for distinguishing this. But having said that, I think that there's something going on here because Paul tells Timothy later in chapter 5 to use a little wine for his stomach's sake and for his oft infirmities. And you also have the issue of the Lord's Supper. Grape juice, you can't really defend grape juice from the Bible. You know, the idea of the sacramental Jewish wines were well understood, and that was what was being used in that gathering, that first gathering. So I don't know. There had to be some drinking of wine, but you know what I'm saying? But I think this not given to wine is referring to a type of abstinence, or it wouldn't have said not given to much wine for the deacons. And I think that obviously there's reasons because of John the Baptist. And I'm willing to be open to different ideas and conclusions about that, but that's just kind of where I stand from my study of this and reading of it, and I think everybody pretty much was saying similar things to that. The next thing says, no striker, not greedy of filthy lucre, but patient, brawler, not covetous. All these things, some of them are deal breakers, I believe. Not a striker, not greedy of filthy lucre. It's really, I don't know how you could tell right off the bat if somebody was greedy of filthy lucre, you know, in an application process. Are you greedy of filthy lucre? So, I'm sorry, check, you know. I mean, I don't know how that would come about, but I think it does come through in some of the other qualifications and things as far as reputation and things that they're asked about the business community sort of at large. Must have a good rapport of them, as we'll find out later. But patient is probably something that if you know the person, you know you've been around them, they've possibly been in the church for a while, that kind of thing, you would know these kinds of things, if they're patient or not. But I think it's also something that if you found out they weren't patient or that they were greedy or maybe a brawler. I don't know, this term, I actually didn't look up brawler, but it seems to be contrasted with the word striker, which is in this verse 2, which I do think has the idea of not really reacting when people entice you. Like if somebody said something to you, you wouldn't react to them in that fleshly way, to be kind of meek in that regard. So be patient, not a brawler, not covetous. Covetous has the connotation of sort of a idolatry even, and the love of money is the root of all evil, and it is something that we should watch out for, because even good men can be tempted in this way. So, especially as we'll find in the deacons too, it's very brought out there, because I think that they generally would be a lot of the people holding the money, holding the purses, and that is extremely important. So many churches have, you know, risen great controversy because of mishandling of the funds and things like that. Judas actually was the holder of the purse in Jesus's band of people there. So I don't know if it was a blessing or curse to hold that purse, but hey, I made a little rhyme there. Isn't that fun? So, okay, so moving on here to verse 4, which is, one that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. I just started to laugh there. I just couldn't imagine too many people having their children in subjection with all gravity, as that translates in the English. I'm just thinking of some children I know, they definitely have the mind of their own, but I don't think that's what's being talked about here necessarily, that they have to be all straight-laced and not acting out or anything like that. In fact, the word here is for small children, which lets people whose children grew up to be not so good, they're off the hook apparently. But I think that even in saying that, it shows kind of what's being sought after here. Because I think if your small children are in subjection, that is indicative of a certain types of qualities that might not even be mentioned in some of the other qualities. Like if it manifests through your children, then you're actually passing a number of other tests. It's just like looking at the fruit of the tree to see if everything else had been going right. So again, a lot of these qualifications are very deep and seem to hold with them a lot of wisdom and in choosing why these particular things. Moving on to verse 5, "For if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God?" Verse 6, "Not a novice, lest being lifted up with pride he fall into the condemnation of the devil." Okay, this word novice here actually means literally like one newly planted. It's a recent convert. And it's probably, there's a lot of reasons why a recent convert shouldn't be in this position, the elder or bishop area, because, as he says, well, the reason he points out is that they could fall into the condemnation of the devil through pride. And it's interesting that Paul told Timothy later on that let no man despise his youth in regards to Timothy being a bishop or an elder. So, and Timothy was probably in his earlier mid-30s, but he wasn't a recent convert either. We're told that, you know, he learned the faith from his grandmother and mother, and also he'd been traveling with Paul for, you know, probably at least a decade or more before this time. So, but again, apparently it is dangerous to bring somebody along too quickly, like a shining star or whatever, because they could fall into the condemnation of the devil through pride. And it's also, you know, somebody, if they're a new convert, they have a lot to learn. And there are, as one commentator pointed out, they're a lot of times relying on their, you know, qualities, whatever it may be, you know, their intelligence or charisma or something like that. They might be leaning a little too hard on their own 2 feet. When, again, as Ray Steadman pointed out, you know, the most important thing is to truly and with all good intention seek the will of Jesus Christ as the head for the people, for Jesus Christ's will. You know, it's got to be really from the heart, genuinely wanting Jesus' will to be done, and to seek that will, I think, is of the utmost importance, and it probably wouldn't be easy for a recent convert, as genuine as they might be, because they might have just a few chinks in their armor, and apparently one of those is pride that the devil could work on. And pride was the devil's sin, and it is something that obviously, I think that it probably is one of the biggest travesties that is attacked to different preachers nowadays, and a lot of the times it is because they are not following the kind of plurality of the elders situation, that there isn't one final authority, and that in itself puts a person in a very big bullseye on somebody with pride. Regardless if they're a recent convert or been a Christian all their lives, if you are the sole person, you get a lot of probably thoughts floated your way about how special you are and blah, blah, blah. And that is a recipe for disaster. It may take a little while, but eventually that will cause trouble, because that's how Satan works. You put a pyramid system in front of Satan and he's like, I can work with that. I can figure something out about how to bring this down. Proverbs 16 verse 18 says, "Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Verse 7, it says, "Moreover, he must be have a good report of them which are without, lest he fall into reproach and the snare of the devil." I have a good report of them which are without. At first I was thinking this is to have a good report of those that don't have things, like the poor. Like you should go ask the poor, like, "Hey, is this guy ever giving you anything?" He's like, "Oh yeah, he's a good guy." And I didn't actually look that word up, and it may mean that, but every commentator that I had listened to and read said that this meant, have a good report of any of people without, like on the outside of the church, like in the world, in the community. And a lot of people told different stories about those kinds of issues and things like that. But I think just in general, they should have a good reputation. This is something that probably would be easier to find out than you would even think. Like, oh my gosh, we got to go interview just people at random. Even if you don't find a great many people to interview at random before a person like this would be appointed, this is the kind of thing that would show up continuously after they were already appointed. You might hear rumors, people say, or maybe not rumors, but you might hear out in the community, people say, oh, him? Really? Him? You know, he's blah, 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 blah. And I think that it would be more obvious, I think, than I was thinking as far as that goes. Because I think that you run into people, if somebody that it would be the type of person that would be in a candidate for an elder position or something like that would probably be somebody that is fairly intelligent and things like that. So probably people have an opinion of him one way or another, you know, and so I guess that's what I'm saying about that. But let's see here. Have a good report of them without, lest you fall into reproach in the snare of the devil. Verse 8, likewise, must the deacons be grave, not double-tongued, not given to much wine, not greedy of filthy lucre. Here we are starting on the deacons. What are deacons? Deacons mean servant. Paul and Apollos were called deacons. It's kind of like elders are deacons, because elders are servants of the church, period. But not all deacons are elders, as we're finding out in these next few verses. A deacon would be like the people in the sixth chapter of Acts that oversaw the food distribution program that the apostles appointed. And it would be the people doing the good works, whether that's practical issues like church finances or ushers or helpers or organ players or whatever it may be. They're all deacons. They should actually start calling them deacons more often, because I think that's what it is. And so if somebody's going to be helping the church in the many different ways that it needs practical help, then they should have these qualities. Grave. Grave here means serious. Again, it was translated as, I believe, sober earlier. But a realist, somebody who is just, serious-minded. Doesn't mean you have to not have a sense of humor, but somebody that's a realist. Not double-tongued. This is interesting because I think, basically this is something that's possible in churches, so especially somebody that would be in an office of a church that would, have an opportunity to try to please everyone, be, everything to everybody, tell one person one thing while telling another person another thing, but somebody that says what they mean and mean what they say kind of thing. And there is a fine line between not necessarily trying to be everything to everybody, but to try to find common ground with everybody, to not say different things or lose integrity in any way, but to try to meet everybody in where you can find common ground, I think, is also important. So it's a fine line. Here we have not given too much wine. So I'm sure that some people would be a reason some people would apply for a deacon rather than a bishop. And then it says not, again, given to filthy lucre, not greedy or filthy lucre. And this seems to have the connotation of just somebody that's not the kind of person who is looking for a fast buck or to take advantage of a situation in order to make money. Somebody who doesn't see that as really, I wouldn't say important, because I think that it is important by definition, but somebody that's not money-minded in that sense. I mean, some people are good with the money. Some people can count and do the numbers and things like that, but then there's money-minded people, wheeling and dealing and things like that. And verse 9, it says, holding the mystery of the faith in a pure conscience. This is an interesting term, holding the mystery of the faith. The word there is mysterion, and it's not the kind of connotation that we have in English. It's kind of the opposite, really. If here we think of mystery as something that has not been solved yet, it's a mystery. Nobody knows. It's a mystery. But this word mysterion has the term of it's been it's been revealed. It was a secret, but now it is not a secret. So it's almost the direct opposite of what we use the word mystery. There are lots of mysteries in the Bible. In this Greek word mystery, the mystery of the incarnation, the mystery of the indwelling of the believers in Colossians 1, that was just in that concept. A lot of these things are something that a lot of times, at least people back then, had a hard time understanding, that God would indwell the believers, that he would become flesh. Those things were like, you know, we take for granted, I think. The mystery of the unity between Jews and Gentiles, Peter had a hard time with that one. I mean, he was like, yeah, but, you know, I'm not going to eat the things that you made unclean. And God had to really point it out to him. It's like, no, I've made them, you know, and Paul goes into great detail about that too. The mystery of the saving gospel in Colossians 4, the mystery of iniquity in 2 Thessalonians 2, and the mystery of the harpazo, or sometimes called the rapture, but as it's 1 Corinthians 15 and 1 Thessalonians 4. And I think that that's an interesting one. There's so much confusion and back and forth about that today. It really isn't any surprise, because everything that's had this term mysterion attached to it has been something that has had a lot of controversy around it. I mean, people really had a lot of controversy at that time about the Jews and Gentiles, you know, being one and things like that. Even the very early church had a lot of problems with some of these mysteries. So what he says in this verse, holding the mystery of the faith in pure conscience. Holding the mystery of the faith. The word faith really isn't an abstract term here. It's speaking of having sound doctrine, I think. Holding the mystery of the faith, having sound doctrine of the doctrines of the faith as they are now revealed. And that they should hold them in pure conscience. Simply, I guess, meaning that they should believe them. They should practice them, and it should be manifested in their life. So I think this is sort of tricky, but also kind of simple at the same time. Verse 10 says, and let these also be first proved, then let them use the office of deacon, being found blameless. I think what's being said here is that they need to be tested. They need to give them an initial assignment as a deacon and then see how they do, or maybe let them be a deacon or do the job for a particular amount of time, you know, having the option of saying, hey, it didn't quite work out, you know, thanks for applying. But I think it's speaking of their track record too, and it seems to go on about that. Verse 11 says, even so must their wives be grave, not slanderers, sober, faithful in all things. Now this is interesting because it's taken a lot of different ways. A lot of people think this is talking about the requirements of the deacon's wives, that a deacon's, if they're going to be a deacon, their wives must be a certain way. I tend to think this is referring to women deaconesses and what they should be like, and I think that there is a difference there, and we'll look at that here in a second. But also, one of the reasons I think this is because there's no corresponding treatment of the wives of the elders. You would expect if this was something that was a concern about how the wives should be of the deacons, then you would expect it to see the same treatment of the elders and bishops as well. But you don't see that. And we do know that in Romans 16, Phoebe was called a deacon and not a deaconess. It's translated as deaconess there. She was a deacon at the Sancria Church, which is a port city at Corinth. And she helped Paul, apparently, specifically as well. But yeah, I tend to think this is referring to that. It says again, even so must their wives be grave, not slanderers, sober, faithful in all things. This first, again, uses the term grave, meaning serious, kind of calm. So that would be the same thing for the for all of these people have had to be serious or cool, as one commentator puts it. That now this is an interesting word here, what they said, not to be slanderers. This word slanderers can translate as diabolos, which means, it was a title for the devils. One person puts it as she-devil in the context of the Greek. But it's because the devil is referred to as the slanderer, and this has the connotation of gossiping. And I think gossip has the potential to break down a church, especially if it was done by a deacon. And so I think maybe that's why this particular provision is made here. Moving on to verse 12, let the deacons be the husbands of one wife, ruling their children and their own house as well. Verse 13, for they have used the office of deacon, well purchased to themselves a good degree and great boldness in the faith which is in Christ Jesus. I think this is a very interesting verse, not necessarily right to look at it, but first of all, what do they do if they use the office of deacon? What kind of payment can you expect? Well, you purchase to yourself a good degree, and that word degree here is like a military term. And you get this good degree and a great boldness in the faith which is in Christ Jesus. So somehow working in the church in some capacity will purchase to yourself great boldness in the faith which is in Christ Jesus. And that is something that, you know, I pray for. I think people should pray for. It's if you're the kind of person that's like, you know, I'm not the kind of person that would do this or do that, you know, pray for boldness in the faith, and you'd just be amazed at how it turns into something that, oh, well, I guess I could do it now that I'm bold, to rather, you know, I'm going to go out and do something. You know, I got to do something about this. So it's interesting. So you should get boldness and confidence in witnessing. I don't know exactly how that would manifest, whether, you know, just by being in the church and being a servant of Christ in a physical way may translate to your rest of your life, you know, that you might have not looked at it in the sense that you're a servant of him in your daily life or something like that. I'm not exactly sure. I don't claim to know exactly how it works there. But it's another thing to point out here. It does seem that deacons from this verse is kind of chosen within the ranks. That is, they wouldn't like import deacons from other places, import workers from other places. They are people chosen from the church, within the ranks of the church. Verse 14, these things write I unto thee, hoping to come unto thee shortly. But if I tarry long, that thou mayest know how thou oughtest to behave thyself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and the ground of the truth. Very amazing here. First, he says the house of the living God. That should probably better be translated household, as in we are all born again into a family. But the interesting part is here, well, first he's saying, I'm telling you how to do this so you guys can do this later on, you know, when I'm not around, kind of thing. But which is he calls the church of the living God, which is the pillar and the ground of truth. Pillars and this idea of ground of truth seem to be holding up and the foundations for truth. And I think that it kind of has this idea of the bedrock. It supports the truth. And that's what the church is. I mean, in our communities, we should be beacons of the truth, and we should let that shine. That's what people should see in the church and have the reputation of the church being. Because the world has said, you know, that the Bible isn't true. They say it's not relevant. They say it's not. But I think that us that know the Bible know how untrue that statement is, and how it is the filter from which the world should be seen. And I know that the world that sounds crazy to the world, but it's only having seen the majesty of the Word of God and its relevance to this world does it become ridiculous to even consider not using it as the filter from which to draw to understand the rest of the truths of the world. Moving on to the last verse, which is, and without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness. God was manifest in the flesh, justified in the spirit, seen of angels, preached unto Gentiles, believed on in the world, received up into glory. And because of the number of adjectives and the meter that this has, and there's a few other things, people have conjectured, scholars, that this is probably a hymn sung by the early church. And it definitely probably was a creed of some sort, but they say probably even a hymn. And this is interesting because, well, for a number of reasons. Apologetics uses these kinds of things a lot when Paul would quote a creed, because it pushes these concepts back to the very early church. Paul was probably writing this around 65 or so AD, so it was already the early church. But this pushes these concepts, which are pretty much a lot of the major doctrines of the church, which is God was manifested in the flesh, which is a big one. People try to say that, you know, the early church never believed that, oh, they didn't believe Jesus was God. Well, sure they did. Paul says it outright here, even if these are just his words, but if he's quoting a hymn, it pushes them believing God was manifested in the flesh back to write after Jesus ascended into heaven, which it says the last one of these is received up into glory. The ascension's mentioned there. So all these things are here in this little creed. So apologetics uses these kinds of things a lot. But it also the justified in the spirit kind of as the virgin birth is in there. So it's a very, very interesting and useful piece of the puzzle if you're interested in things like that. All right, this pretty much wraps up the 1 Timothy chapter 3 commentary. Be back next week, hopefully, with the 1 Timothy maybe 4 and 5. We'll try to combine them there. And at some point, we might do some more topical things and things like that. But I really like going verse by verse because it just seems like it's a deeper understanding of each chapter, and I feel like I am learning a lot. So I might continue this kind of format of just going verse by verse and studying it, or we might have a certain topic. If you have any suggestions or anything like that, comments or critiques or anything like that, you can go to thefullarmorofgod.podomatic.com, and you can find my email address there, which is just as easy to remember, if you can remember that, which is thefullarmorofgod@podomatic.com. So I hope to hear from you, and thank you very much for your time. Bye.